From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, climate change. After Thanksgiving, the Trump administration released the government's latest climate change study. The drop may have been quiet, but the report was a blockbuster.
The congressionally mandated report from 13 federal agencies says climate change could shrink the U.S. economy by hundreds of billions of dollars by the end of the century. The report also warns of
President Trump's response.
Yeah, I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it. And here's the
Trump has long rejected the widespread scientific consensus on the issue that climate change is due to human influence. His stance puts him at odds with his own government's report and the position of much of the world. Last year, he decided to pull the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement, a coalition of 195 other countries.
So we're getting out, but we will start to negotiate, and we will see if we can make a deal that's fair. And if we can, that's great. And if we can't, that's fine.
A new UN report, meanwhile, says the world has only 12 years to stem rising temperatures or face serious risk of drought, floods, extreme heat, climate-related deaths, and devastation for the natural world.
The message is that countries will need to cooperate. We don't have a top-down agreement with Paris, it's bottom-up, but they need to take collaborative and coordinated action if we're actually going to achieve a goal of 1.5 degrees warming.
While some European countries like Norway have set forth rigorous goals for reducing their carbon emissions, the country with one of the most ambitious plans might surprise you. It's Costa Rica. One of the leaders behind this push has been Monica Araya. She is the founder and director of Costa Rica Limpia, that's Spanish for clean. It's a citizen group that promotes clean energy. We reached her in Amsterdam. So, Monica, I'm really curious about why carbon neutrality and green issues was a priority for Costa Rica, given how much of a struggle it's been in so many countries around the world.
Yes, and it is a question that I have asked myself many times. Why is it that already in the 90s, we had 20 years of experience taking care of our natural capital? So we have to go back to the 70s at a time where developing countries were pretty aggressive in terms of their developmental policies, and in a decade where there was conflict and the environment was not a priority in Latin America. Why is it that some people in my country decided that it was a very good idea to create national parks and to protect them? I personally attribute that to the fact that we grew up in a country that saw itself as different because we did not have an army.
Does that mean that defense spending, therefore that money was available to look at in terms of environmental protection? Why would the army, or lack of an army, enable the country to see itself in a green context?
It is a strong message to a country. You know, when you say we're not going to have an army, even though the rest of the world has an army. So already there in 48, 49, there was a sense that you had to create your own vision. Even though we were small, even though it was different from others, we had to create our own pathway. At the time, in the late 40s, it wasn't the environment that really created a sense of purpose. What did was the notion that we had to invest in our social welfare, and that at the time meant schools and it meant hospitals because people needed safety nets. There was a sense of social welfare because people like my parents went to public school. There is, you know, public education is a right in Costa Rica and is embedded in the constitution. And at the same time, if you are in Costa Rica and you are sick, the hospitals will probably take a long time to take you, but they will take you for free. I also believe that the connection between not having the army and having more resources is that this sense of safety net makes people have a sense of collective self that sometimes you miss in countries where everybody has to take care of itself, of herself or himself. And then you are already in the 50s or 60s where you have built this country that is stable, that has no army, that has these social institutions. And around the 70s, Costa Rica had this pressure to start thinking about sources of energy such as coal. And we know very well that the problem today is that the world has a coal addiction. So why is it that we didn't develop that addiction in the 70s? And what is interesting is that at the time, even though there was pressure to go for coal, these engineers, very Costa Rican, very much committed to the idea of using our own resources, said, yeah, it could be cheaper, but we want to stick to water. And at the time, hydro was a big thing for them.
I want to understand better, I mean, for you, and I understand the history, and we're talking about the 40s and when your parents were children, but for yourself as a child in, let's say, the late 70s and early 80s, did you have a sense already then of both the social contract and also the way the environment played a role in that?
I do believe in the power of stories and in the power of narratives. And it was very empowering for a small girl to have the sense that you had been born in a country that was different, that was special, that did not have an army. So I used to hear, you live in a country that doesn't have soldiers, it has teachers. So when you have that kind of empowering story in your head as a child, I do believe it does something to you. And it is that when you grow up, you try to punch above your weight. So we sometimes as Costa Ricans laugh because when we interact with the world, we sometimes have to remind ourselves that we are a very unimportant country because we act as if we were important. And it's probably because of these joint stories. But I also grew up with a very strong sense that a lot of people in Costa Rica were not poor and were not rich. And as a kid, that's how I thought about it. So you did have the conditions to have people like me and many others. I'm not obviously the only one, many, many others who grew up thinking, you know, now it's my turn to be special and to do something special for the country. And by the time we had to choose a career, many of us happened to be at university at a time where biodiversity became such a big thing. In Costa Rica, we were doing the National Institute for Biodiversity. We had already national parks for 20 years. There was a president at the time who was very green for Latin American standards. So by the time 2008 came and we decided to approach carbon neutrality, a lot of developing countries were upset. Like, why on earth would you want to be carbon neutral? We don't have obligations. They have obligations to give us money first. And in Spanish, there is a word called sapo, which means it's like a toad. And it means, you know, when you are a person who wants to be ahead of the others, you are a sapo because you're just, you are. And and we were very aware that in the context of the G77 and China, we sounded like a sapo because at the end of the day, the developing country bloc was arguing the case against climate action, against climate responsibility. We actually decided this without having the plan. We were not asking engineers first, can we be carbon neutral so that we can announce it? It was completely the opposite way. And of course, that has an advantage, which is that it forces you to learn and to experiment. But the downside is that it is difficult. You know, nobody has done it before.
A lot of Costa Rica's energy needs are met now by hydro, wind, and geothermal energy to power homes. Tell me how it works.
The way it works is through a state-owned enterprise, which is called ICE. Is the National Institute for Electricity, and it was an institution that was born back in the 40s when we had this, you know, this new constitution and we were recreating the country. Because they were so adamant to go for hydro, they basically stuck with hydro, you know, they basically wanted to keep it that way, and then started to diversify by including energy coming from volcanoes. We have a lot of volcanoes for such a small country. and we have also wind. So around 75%, a bit more, comes from hydro, and then around 12% comes from wind, and around 10-12% comes from geothermal. So the summary is that in 2018, when you take a shower, when you dry your hair, when you prepare coffee, that electricity, most days of the year, comes from non-fossil fuels. So it is also quite interesting for us that when it comes to energy debates, you still have countries that are saying by 2030, this percentage of electricity generation will come from renewable sources. And then you scratch your head and you go like, interesting, because in Costa Rica, it's like 99% is already renewable.
But you don't have a gas and oil industry, so there isn't the same pushback that there are in other countries. That makes Costa Rica unusual.
I think it is very important to stress the point you just made about incumbency, because the way many times I felt in the climate negotiations was, you know, there you have all these countries and they felt like smokers that are trying to agree on, you know, on the terms for quitting, you know, okay, I will quit if you quit, or I will quit by that year if you quit as well. And often I had the sentiment that Costa Rica was a non-smoker and that much of our task ahead was to avoid becoming a smoker, because the pressure is there. The pressure to go for gas is huge in Latin America, especially in the context of gas abundance in the US. The pressure to do a refinery, oil refinery with China was there in 2013. So we need to keep avoiding creating this incumbency, because we know from a lot of experience around the world that once the oil and gas industry exists, it wants to exist for a long time, and it would be the wrong fuel, the wrong idea, the wrong time.
The pressure is there. Costa Rica has resisted it. But then how replicable is it, the model that Costa Rica is presenting, if other countries have either already submitted to that pressure or have a harder time resisting it?
It is true that Costa Rica is exceptional when it comes to power generation, when it comes to sources of electricity. However, when it comes to energy for transportation, we are very much like the rest of the world. We are very addicted to oil, and we use a lot of gasoline and a lot of diesel. And in that sense, we do face the same dilemma, which is that the installed capacity, you know, the fleets, the gas stations, the refinery, which is owned by the state, that infrastructure wants to continue existing. What I do believe could come from the big experiment that Costa Rica represents, because at the end of the day, it is a big experiment. Nobody has gone fossil free. We can be used as a lab. We are the country that can be a testing ground, because if we want this to succeed, people have to own it. People have to wake up in the morning, and people have to make a lot of decisions throughout the day that will have to be consistent with a fossil-free society. The way they use their cars or not use them, or the car they buy, the house they build. Nobody's doing this right now, but you need the small guys pushing the big guys, and we are very unapologetic about having big ideas, even though we are a small country.
Can you talk to us, though, a little bit about some of the setbacks you've had in that vision?
There are several things. We have a lot of movement toward electric mobility, because we realize that for the first time in decades, technology is on our side. So we start pushing for a big idea, which is, why don't we electrify everything? And then the pushback starts from the car industry. The pushback we got in 2016 was something I never experienced in my life. I mean, I had people coming on the stage where I was speaking in Costa Rica and trying to do, you know, character assassination, you start seeing this vested interest confusing public opinion, saying that it is not advisable to change to electric mobility. But at the same time, you have pushback from this parts of government. And I think that is where it gets very interesting. So in Costa Rica, what you have now is a very interesting puzzle. You have a young president with a very brilliant wife, totally on board. You have a Ministry of Environment who is a champion, is a person who led the moratorium on oil 15 years ago. And what happens is the refinery says, oh yeah, you want to decarbonize? Good luck, because we have 1,500 workers. So are you going to put them out? And are you going to kill their jobs? Great. You know, and they have this way of presenting a very black and white picture and saying, okay, decarbonization is going to kill these people's jobs. So if we want to get this right, I do believe that there will be no choice but to engage with strategies for the social transitions or fair, just transitions, as you know, as some people call them, because it is true that some of the job creation will take place in parts of the economy that are very dynamic, you know, ecotourism, services. You can create a portfolio, but it's not the same people who are losing the job from a refinery, and we just have to accept that.
This episode of First Person is brought to you by the Fletcher School's Master of International Business program at Tufts University, where the MBA meets the world. Today's business professionals should be well-versed not only in management and strategy, but also in the complex issues that impact businesses today. That way, they can understand not just how markets work, but why they work. From social impact to economic stability to environmental factors, MIB students gain contextual intelligence, helping them confront the complicated realities of an interconnected world. Learn more and view a virtual information session at fletcher.tufts.edu/business.
When you said that you were personally attacked, though, that there were character assassinations, can you give me an example? What happened? And how did you handle it?
Well, luckily, I was a negotiator in the UN for a few years, so I am familiar with the kind of dynamics that basically try to intimidate you, so I could recognize them. And in the context of Costa Rica, what happened was that we tried to pass this law in Congress, and the woman who was sponsoring the legislation was there, and we organized an event, and the owner of a car dealership that is very important in my country because it wins a lot of the governmental contracts. He was there, literally sitting in the front row, and he brought his CEO, and in the middle of my presentation, stood up and just came on the stage and basically said, you should not believe this woman because she has hired this journalist to speak bad things about our company, which is absolutely not true. So it was the first time in my life where I witnessed fear, because this is fear. I mean, you to get such a powerful man to come to an event, to sit in the first row and to literally fabricate a lie is because they are afraid of what you're trying to do. And in that moment, you asked me how I handled it. What I can tell you is that all I saw was a millennial at the back of the room filming. In my head, a light bulb went and I said, I have to be very calm so that they show this image will show how afraid they are, but also what a bully strategy they are using. This was in Facebook Live. And the bigger point is that this is going to continue happening. So I, on the one hand, I'm very optimistic that we will eventually win people and consumers. But I don't think it's just a matter of being optimistic, but it's also a matter of being courageous. It will take a lot of courage in the next 5 to 10 years to stick to this because it's going to get nasty.
So Costa Rica has not banned carbon emissions, though, at this point. And why not?
So the country has a moratorium on oil exploration and exploitation. That happened about 15 years ago, and it has been sustained over 5 governments and 3 political parties, which is a very important achievement. Even governments who didn't agree with the moratorium had to stick to it because they knew there would be a backlash. So there is that, and that meant not allowing companies to come into the drilling because there is some potential for oil exploration, exploitation in our oceans. So there is the first point. The second is that post-Paris Agreement, the government has announced the National Decarbonization Plan, and it goes from 2018 to 2050. And in essence, it is the most concrete plan we ever had. And the question is, how do you get to 2050 and become a fossil-free society? And it goes from transportation to agriculture to livestock to all the sectors and is informed by our national CO2 inventory.
Energy for homes is green, but Costa Rica has a problem with cars, just like the rest of the world. And car ownership per capita is high, and it's growing. And as I understand it, only 2% of those cars are electric. You can offset most of those emissions, but what's the solution to the car problem?
Obviously, our weak spot is transportation. So we have a problem with congestion, and we have a problem with pollution because the fleets for public transit, they are old, and for cars, they are completely dependent on gasoline and diesel. So what do we do about that? The first is to definitely tackle public transit because it's polluting, it's old, and a lot of people use it. So it's, on the one hand, it's decarbonization, yes, but it's also about modernization. And there is a pilot that was launched in June this year. And in my view, this is going to be a game changer because once people see the electric buses, they will love them. Two, the First Lady's office, given her background in architecture and urban issues, has taken on board the very visible project of building an electric train. We have right now an ugly diesel train, and it transports a lot of people, and it's incredible that people use it because it's loud and it's very dirty. So this is one of the most popular projects right now, the famous electric train. The other thing that is going on is a push from very young constituencies, especially millennials. They want to ride bikes. They want Costa Rica to allow them to bike and not die. It is a fascinating story of urban activism. You know, it is a good way of reducing emissions and to give them freedom because they don't want to be in cars. The other thing that is happening is that now the country has created the first law in Latin America that gives incentives to anything that is electric. Could be a bike, could be a bus, could be a truck, could be a car. And the idea is to, for now, for a few years, it's not permanent, to give them a tax benefit. They don't pay any taxes. And the logic is that we need for a few years to make sure that if you are going to buy a car, it better be electric.
And you think this will incentivize people to pick up electric cars or move more towards electric cars if they have those tax incentives?
Yes. So what we have discovered is that in a country that has already this green narrative, in a country that already has this increasing sense of pride around clean electricity, a lot of people see their buying a car as a way of being part of this big transition. And I do think that from a theory of change perspective, this is very strategic because if you talk about decarbonization in a way that sounds like it's only for politicians or for engineers and for experts, and you're not part of that, it's just not going to work. So these people who buy electric cars and become activists, a lot of them are women. You know, when they go and convince their cousin or their sisters or their neighbors, it's really good because we've learned from Norway that a person who switches on average convinces 3 more people. And this is critical because of what I told you before about car dealerships and their skepticism and their tactics. So now we have, for the first time, the incentives also for fleets. And the point here is that the state, the Costa Rican state, buys a lot of cars for ministries, for the public universities. And these cars, if they are going to buy them, they better be electric, because it doesn't make sense for the state to buy gasoline cars and then have to fuel them with foreign oil. So that is why this year it will be the launching of the first 100 electric cars by the national utility. It's the largest institutional purchase of electric cars in Latin America. And what happens is that because this is getting somewhere, the national insurance company is also offering 15% discount if you switch to electric. And the post service company announced last week that some of their motorbikes, they will also electrify them. So something is going on with these electric technologies that are allowing people to feel part of something that is not just about the purchase, it's about being part of this big fossil-free shift that we want to enable in the country.
What do you make of the latest U.S. climate report, which came out last week? It was pretty dire.
Well, we know that that report, together with the 1.5 degree report that came out from the IPCC in October, are confirming things that we knew, which is that this is real, this is happening, and we need to take science seriously. So right now, at least in Costa Rica, there is a sense of absence because we have lost a partner in the U.S. The tricky part is that on the one hand, you have to not walk away from the serious trouble we are in. We have to not deny that this is serious and that people will die as a consequence of extreme weather. We cannot walk away from that reality. But we have to pivot very quickly to avoid despair. And I do think that if there is something I like about Costa Rica and Latin America in general, is that we are resilient. We have gone through so much in our countries, and yet people have a sense of hope because there is a safety net that allows people to feel they will be protected if they get in trouble, or if the country gets in trouble from, you know, from a social perspective or from an environmental perspective. But in the U.S., because you have this lack of safety nets, it is very difficult for a lot of Americans to get a sense of hope. And I do struggle with what's going on in the U.S. I lived in the U.S. for 8 years. I got my PhD there. And right now, what I can tell you is that it is painful to watch.
Monica, this has been really enlightening. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
You are very welcome. And thank you so much for this very generous space. I rarely do interviews that give me more than 10 minutes.
Muchas gracias por todo.
Muchísimas, muchísimas gracias.
A usted. That's Monica Araya. She's the founder and director of Costa Rica Limpia, a citizen group that promotes clean energy. First Person is produced by Dan Efron and edited by Rob Sachs. I'm Sarah Wildman, and I've been your host.